Hi, I'm Cam, and this is the Nerdbook Review, where we strive to broaden your fantasy horizons. Today, I will be reviewing Shadow of a Dead God by Patrick Samphire. I'll give you the book info and author bio, and then we'll do the book blurb and get into the review. So, it is 462 pages long, published in 2020. It is the first book in the Menic Thorn series. Menic Thorn is also the name of the main character in the books. I am releasing this episode just a couple of weeks before the final book in the series is released. So, if you want to listen to this and you care about books being done when you start them, in case you are traumatized like I have been more than once with a series not being finished, then that is not a worry. Let's go ahead and read the author's bio. Patrick Samphire is the author of the adult fantasy novels Shadow of a Dead God, Nectar for the God, Strange Cargo, and the forthcoming Legacy of a Hated God, as well as the middle grade novels Secrets of the Dragon Tomb and The Emperor of Mars. He has published around 20 short stories and novellas as well. Patrick has been writing stories since he was 14 years old and thought it would be a good way of avoiding having to sit through English lessons at school. He was absolutely convinced that he would be famous by the time he was 18, but sadly, even infamy has eluded him. He lives in Wales, surrounded by mountains, with his wife, their sons, and their cat. When he's not writing, he designs websites and ebooks. He will now stop talking about himself in the third person. All right, let's do the book cover. A dead god, a brutal murder, a second-rate mage. It was only supposed to be one little job. A simple curse-breaking for Menic Thorn to pay back a favor to his oldest friend. But then it all blew up in his face. Now he's been framed for a murder he didn't commit. So how's a second-rate mage, broke, traumatized, and with a habit of annoying the wrong people, supposed to prove his innocence when everyone believes he's guilty? Menic has no choice if he wants to get out of this. He's going to have to throw himself into the corrupt world of the city's high mages, a world he fled years ago. Faced by supernatural beasts, the mage killing Ashgard in a ruthless, unknown adversary, it's going to take every trick Menic can summon just to keep him and his friend alive. But a new, dark power is rising in Agathos, and all that stands in his way is one damaged mage. My take. A down-on-his-luck mage must figure out how to clear his name before one of any number of people or things take him down. So, the book review itself. First off, this was a book that I really enjoyed and that surprised me part of the way through. For about 60% of the time, I would have said this is a good, solid book. It will be a solid 4-star, certainly good enough for me to put on the podcast and, you know, something a little bit different from most of the books that I've been doing. It's not a multi-point of view character book where, you know, we go all over the place and it's like a true epic fantasy. This is more like urban fantasy, but it's set in the Renaissance time period is what I would have called it. It is a secondary world, so we're not dealing with, you know, the Earth here. But technology-wise, we're about what I would think of as Renaissance. And then all of a sudden, at that 60% point, things started getting real interesting. 80% in, there was a huge twist. Suddenly the book was just nonstop action and entertaining and took some turns, twists and turns that I did not expect. And all of a sudden I was at that 80, 90% point. It's 8:45 at night, which might sound very early for most of you, but when you get up at 3 in the morning to go to work, it is actually very late. And so I try to go to bed. We try to put the kids to bed at 8, and then I try to be asleep, if it's all possible, by about 8:30, 8:45. So I was still reading when I should have been already asleep. And suddenly there's that 5-star indicator when I do not want to put the book down. I think I got to about 90% when I finally quit. And then as soon as I got to work the next morning, I finished the book off. And I was just super, super entertained. So, like I said, it was one of those books. It's a slow burn. So if it's something, if you happen to read this book because of this review, the first you know, 60%. And I know that sounds like a lot. And I'm not saying that it was a boring book for the first 60%. I'm saying that it was just your standard urban fantasy, more of a detective whodunit type novel than a fantasy story even at times. I don't think that for a lot of the beginning part of it, magic was really all that integral. It didn't seem like it was all that integral to the story. And if Menek hadn't been, you know, that second-rate mage, as the story said, then it could have been a detective novel set in, you know, the Renaissance time period. The book is funny, too. There's definitely a lot of dry humor. It's not absurdly funny. No one's going out of their way to be humorous, but that dry humor that gets in there, I absolutely laughed several times during the book, and I think you're supposed to. So it was an entertaining book, even that first 60%. But like I said, for that first part, I'm just sitting there thinking, this is a good book. I'm enjoying reading it. I'll read the next one. And that's where it was until all of a sudden it just went into hyperdrive. So let's go ahead and describe the book, the world. As I usually start off with the world as the first thing, especially when there's multi-point of view characters, this one we're going to just kind of put everything into how the main character, Menek Thorne, sees things, since his is the only viewpoint we get. Menek is a second-rate mage, as we're told when the story starts. He had been employed by one of the three high mages that rule the city, but then he left for what are initially unspecified reasons. It is clear, though, that part of the reason that he left was because he has a real conscience when most of the other mages in the city don't. He says that basically that power breeds corruption and power breeds wanting more power, and he didn't want any part of that. So he is a freelance mage, and that's something that is definitely not the norm. As I said, almost all of the other mages are under one of the three high mages who are ruling the city. We'll talk about them as we go farther in. So the way the story starts, he's at the beginning, is he is employed by a rich family to perform an exorcism of ghosts, but he doesn't really believe those ghosts exist. And he falls asleep while he's being forced to hide in the pantry because she thinks that that's going to help the ghosts show up. He explains that's not how it works, that ghosts, if they're there in a spot, they don't care who's there to see them or not. They're just reenacting whatever trauma they initially had, but she makes him stay in the pantry anyway, so he does. Well, he falls asleep. He wakes up just as those ghosts are starting to go into the basement. He loses them, and then the man of the house gets upset. He gets fired or just told to go home anyways. He is fired, but he's at the time he just thinks he's been told to leave. And so he's down on his luck a little bit. He goes home to his office. When he gets to his office, he sees an eviction notice on his door because he hasn't paid rent, because clearly things aren't going very well for him. Then he goes inside to find his best friend, since he was a small child, named Benny, sitting in his office, who has somehow also managed to break through the wards that he's set on there. Once again, he's a second-rate mage, but he's still a mage. Benny tells him that he owes him a favor and he needs to call it in. Now, his buddy Benny is a pretty funny character. He's one of those guys, he's always upset that if someone is calling him out for something or calling him a thief, he'll get accused of stealing and then he'll get upset and say, "I can't believe those guys accused me of stealing." And Thorne will say, "Well, didn't you steal their stuff?" And Benny will reply, "Well, that's not the point. They can't prove it." I happen to have a close family member, who I have dealt with that absurdity of. And I'm not going to name names, but if anybody of my buddies are listening to this, they'll know exactly who I'm talking about. Where they'll get caught, or they haven't actually been caught yet, but it's, you know that they did what they did. Everybody knows that they did what they did, but they're going to be upset that you would call them out on it and say, "How dare you not believe me?" Well, that's kind of how Benny is at all times. But they have been good buddies ever since they were kids, and I don't know what exact favors Benny has done for Thorne, but that's kind of how Benny operates, is that he operates on favors, and if you owe him, eventually, if he calls him in then and you're his friend, then you're going to have to do it. So Benny's favor that he has is he wants Menek Thorne to go with him while they steal an artifact from one of those three high mages named Silkstar. Silk Star lives in a palace called the Palace of a Thousand Walls, because within it, he's got a whole bunch of wooden panels and things that they can move around to change the shape of the palace as they need. And at the beginning, it's been changed around for one of the god festivals. There are, it seems like, hundreds of gods that are mostly dead from what we can tell. They can be killed by mortals, and I'll actually go in more into that here after I get done describing it. But as far as I can tell, there's not a whole lot of actual living gods that are providing a lot of real benefits to the people. But the Benny and Thorn go to steal this artifact, and Thorn is there because the artifact is cursed, and one thing that Thorn is really good at is breaking curses. So Benny wants him there to do it. Thorn says it's one of those things that's actually real easy to break a curse. You just have to, you know, be delicate. So that goes awry. A very important person ends up being murdered when the plan backfires. And it wasn't something that Thorn did to cause, you know, the person to be murdered, but he is clearly being framed for it. And so almost the entire remainder of the story, which actually takes place over just, you know, a handful of days, it feels like a lot longer time period because of how much actually happens during the book. But the rest of the book is spent with Thorn and Benny trying to avoid being either murdered or captured and killed by one of the two authorities that are in the official authorities, if you will, in the city. There's the city guard and a group called the Ash Guard as well that I'll talk about. So the entire story takes place in a single city called Agathos. I hope I'm saying that right. It's named after its founder, a man named Agathe Blackspear, who supposedly founded the city. Anyone who has any sort of learning knows this is probably not true. That people have lived on this, what is now the city of Agathos, for thousands of years, just based on the sheer number of dead gods there are throughout the city. That's obviously clear that there's been, you know, people have been there for a long period of time. What makes Agathos so important and is such a rich city, if you happen to be rich, there's obviously lots of income inequality, but the rich are very rich in this town, is that it's a port city. And on one side of it, where the port is, the trade winds and the currents both blow people right to the city. And then on the other end of the city, if you kind of think of it as sitting on a spit of land with mountains around it, it has also the only pass that goes into the inland cities through it. So ships show up and drop off goods, and then traders leave to go inland and take those goods. So people who have, you know, the actual merchants and traders are very wealthy in this city, so are bankers. Then the way the city's broken down is you have the port part, then you have a part of the city that's called the Warrens. It's where the very poor live. It's not very well taken care of. People are not, people are very poor in certain areas. And that area of the city and the underworld of the city is ruled by a high mage called the Wren. The Wren is the person that we see the least of in this book. In fact, we don't see the Wren directly at all. It sounds like the Wren's going to be more important for the second book in the series. The city then, on one side of it, has what's called the Stacks. That's where most of the foreigners and the foreign, like, dock workers and things like that, where most of them live. And then you'll go up from the Warrens to a part of the area that's called the Gray City. The city walls apparently are bright white, but then you get this part that's not quite as bad as the Warrens, where the Gray City is, where they don't whitewash the walls regularly. And that's where Thorn happens to be, and where the people who aren't quite poor enough to need to live in the Warrens but aren't rich enough to own a house on one of the hills, that's where they live. Then you have the city as it goes farther inland, it rises up on a hill. Then you have, like, the palace and the places where all the rich people live so that they can be above the stink and away where the winds take it away from them. And so the city is very well described. You know, it's a character in the book for sure. We find that magic, it's not like everybody has magic, but it's not so rare that there's only a few mages. It takes a long time to become a mage, to practically be a mage. People have the power born, they're born with it. But you don't just become, you're not a good mage because you're born with it. It's not like one of the, several of the other books that I've done recently where you're born with the power level that you're going to have. You have to take years and years to first train, and then Manic says that the first year of training is just learning how to suck power within you. And then after that first year, if you're a decent mage, then you'll learn how to let the power go and how you shape it and things like that. The city itself, I guess one thing I better, get into is I've already mentioned that the city is ruled by three high mages: the Wren, who runs the underworld, the Silk Star, who runs the city merchants, and then a third character, she's called the Countess, and she runs the politics. There's a Senate in the city. I don't know how effective the Senate itself is, but she's the head of it. All three of them are high mages, and they are the three most powerful mages in the city. I'll talk about magic a little bit more, and then I'll also talk about the Ashguard, who is the balance to those three high mages. So the Ashguard is a group that actually puts the ashes of a dead god on their physical body. Those ashes negate magic at all. So the Ashguard, they're not out there policing the city streets like the city guard is for, pickpockets and things like that. They intervene when a mage does something bad that they need to be stopped for. So if mages are fighting other mages, as long as they're not hurting their average person, then the Ashguard's not going to participate. But if the mages are hurting other people, even a high mage could be stopped by the Ashguard, because you can't use magic around an Ashguard. That ash negates not just magic that you try to use, but like a mage can't even feel their magic when an Ashguard is within about 20 feet of them. And potentially even it could be even farther if there's more of them together, right? There's a void around wherever they are. Now, the way that they get their power is also something that is going to help describe magic as well. So all magic is put there is basically the is described as the rotting essence of all of these dead gods. So many gods have died in Agathos and are now apparently decomposing magically somehow, that their essence can be used by these mages, by people who have the power to take in magic. Well, the Ashguard gets their lack of magic the same way, because a sun god died, and wherever that sun god happens to be decomposing, the ashes of their body, of its body, are giving them the power to negate magic, because when that god was alive, it actually negated the magic of other gods. So it does the same thing for mages who are using that magic. So the Ashguard are much feared by the mages, but like I said, they're not involved in other things. They do use muskets and swords, but certainly swords are still the most prominently used thing. So that's why I get that early Renaissance feel of things where people aren't around wearing a whole bunch of armor because of magic, because both magic and muskets, but swords are still seem to be the main mundane method of a weapon. So getting back into the way the magic works, as I said, you have Thorn, who uses magic. He actually is able to see. He unfocuses his eyes and goes into his magic vision, if you will. And then he's able to see magic as colors, and then he shapes those colors to use the magic. Now, other mages, he says, do it differently. So some might hear it as a song, so they can, shape songs, and that's how they shape magic. Some, he even says, can taste it. I don't know. He says he's not quite sure how that works, but that each mage does things their own way. There's lots of different ways, and I don't know if there's a reason why it happens the way it happens, but it does. So, like I said, so we have one city, one main character, The city is run by high mages with the Ashguard as the balance to those high mages. City guard that, you know, controls the general population. And within those mages, basically we're told that three is a great number of high mages to have. You have the one, because the other two are never going to let the third one can really take things over like they would. They might want to try. Mages want power because they have power. And so that's another important thing. One thing, Thorne has a kind of a funny and flirty relationship with one of the Ashguard captains, who you don't really know if she likes him, but every time he's around her, he gets flustered, and it's kind of funny because he's kind of like a schoolboy when he's in having those encounters, and there's a little bit of that sexual tension and fear at the same time because she is an Ashguard and he's a mage, so. You know, he wouldn't have any way to, if she wanted to kill him instead of flirt with him, then there's nothing he could do to stop her. All in all, it is definitely a fun character-driven book that I really enjoyed. The magic system is something that, you know, is a little fluid. I wouldn't call it the hardest of all of magic systems, but it does follow general rules. The more powerful of a mage you are, the better spells you can do. I think I've made him sound like he's a completely two-bit mage, but they say that he's kind of like a middling power mage. There's lots of mages that have less power than he does, and lots, you know, 50% roughly that have more power than he does, some of them a lot more. But he's always described as, because he knows he doesn't have a ton of power, but he has really good training, that he is able to do spells, more intricate spells than a lot of other mages, because he has to be able to. Sometimes his magic's not strong enough to do something, so he's going to have to make a more intricate spell to do that same thing that a more powerful mage could just use through brute force. And there's a lot of humor throughout the book. There's no, like, sit-down info dump that happens in some. And, you know, I've mentioned I like info dumps, but I also, I don't need an info dump, if it can be described in a good enough way that I have a pretty good idea of what's going on, even if I haven't been sat down and told exactly. Menik is a character that I really liked. I liked him as a character. I liked Benny, even though Benny's ridiculous. And there aren't too many other ones that you have a whole lot of. That Ashguard captain, Benny's 11-year-old daughter, who Menik is absolutely terrified of because she seems to be a little mini assassin in the training, and so he's always terrified of her. She just shows up randomly. He'll suddenly have a dagger in his back, and Sarah is all of a sudden right behind him, and he's like, how did she do this to me? I should have had wards that she never triggered. But anyways, so getting into the recommendation phase on the did we like it and that stuff, like I said at the very beginning, I really enjoyed this book. Like I said, there was a slow burn, and then when it just got entertaining, it was very entertaining. Sometimes I thought that a lot more time had passed because so many things kept happening, you know, like one after the other, even during the same day. On the how did it make us feel thing, I'm actually going to go a little differently than the usual. Because I don't necessarily know that this was a book that even tried to hit you in the feels too much. But I did feel suspense sometimes because so much was happening. There was that mystery. And sometimes there might be an attack that just happened all of a sudden. And you're hoping that even if you don't think Thorne's going to die, maybe, you wonder if some of the side characters are going to die. So there would be suspenseful periods where I would find myself wanting to read even faster than I already was reading, because I wanted to see what was going to happen. So that's the kind of thing that is also fun when a book can do that to you too. So sometimes it doesn't have to hit you in the feels where you have tears, but sometimes you have suspense and you're like, oh goodness, what's going to happen, kind of a thing. On the would we recommend to others part, this is going to be one that I actually would recommend to a wide range of people. I think if you are the kind of person that needs an epic fantasy, then clearly this isn't the book for you. There's the magic. There are lots of gods that we don't mostly see. We only actually see direct evidence of two gods through the book. And as the book title might describe, one of them's already dead. So it's mostly just people. There's no mythical creatures aside from, you know, some godlike creatures, some beast god creatures. But other than that, you're dealing with humans, most of whom are just living their mundane lives. And even though, you know, most of the people we interact with are mages within the book, because Menek is a mage, and, you know, that's the way to be an entertaining part of the story. But the average person's just going about trying to live their daily life, to work, to go to one of the festivals that's in the city, and you're not dealing with elves and all that kind of stuff. So if you need epic fantasy, then maybe this isn't the book for you. But I actually have a father-in-law who loves detective novels. He reads all of those awful detective novels on Kindle Unlimited. And I'm not suggesting this is an awful detective novel. I'm just saying I don't like those detective novels. I swear that some of them are, you know, silly. But he likes those kind of books. He also will occasionally read a fantasy novel. I mean, he read all of the Song of Ice and Fire, for example, years ago, well before the TV series came out. So as long as it's not too epic fantasy, then he likes it. So I feel like this is the kind of book that could be a crossover book where people who aren't opposed to the idea of fantasy, but that's not what they normally read, that this would be the kind of book that they would like. So I feel like this could potentially have a wide audience. It's not going to have, maybe, you know, like I said, if you're an epic fantasy only kind of person, then maybe it's not the book for you. But as a general rule, I don't think there's too many people that wouldn't enjoy reading it. On how would we rate it on a 5-star system, as I said, I'm giving it that hard 5 out of 5 because I couldn't put it down towards the end. And on the who is the main audience and who should and shouldn't read it, he mentions this is an adult novel, but there's no sex scenes. And I don't remember there being a ton of vulgar language. Quite a few people are literally ripped apart. So there's definitely some of that. I still feel like, for the most part, that even if you were a younger teen, that most parents would be okay with their teens reading this book. And so it's an adult novel, but it's not grimdark by any means. So I think that most teenagers on all the way up till adults would enjoy it. On my closing thoughts, this was just a really fun book. And one thing I want to put about it too is that I think I would recommend this book to people who say you are grimdark readers. Sometimes if I read like 3 or 4 grimdark novels in a row, then I kind of start to notice it affecting my mood occasionally, especially if I'm reading in, like, say, the winter. So I'm a real big proponent of palate cleansers, even if that's what you, even if grimdark is most of what you read. And I feel like this would just be a great palate cleanser book because it's just so entertaining and action-packed, and there's mystery in it. And so I think that, you know, that's why I said I really do feel like this book has a lot of a wider audience than some of the other books that I do. So good times, fun stuff.